Hey everybody, it's Bob here with a special announcement about our next live panel. It shouldn't come as any surprise, but we will be heading back to the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and yes, of course, Portland, Oregon, for another live Retronauts panel. PRGE happens from Friday, October 18th to Sunday, October 20th, but our panel will be at 9 p.m. on Saturday in Auditorium A, and the topic will be When Celebrities and Video Games Collide. It's going to be a fun late-night panel, and we'll have tons of amazing clips of some of the worst celebrity appearances in video games and a few of the best. Again, that is happening at 9 p.m. on Saturday, October 19th at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo in Auditorium A. But we recommend you stay for the entire weekend and enjoy the fun festivities of PRGE. Thanks again for listening, and we'll let you get back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Welcome to Retronauts at Long Island Retro Gaming Expo featuring Hardcore Gaming 101. I am Jeremy Parrish, and these guys with me here.
Kurt Collada.
And I'm Rob Russo from the HG 101 podcast.
Thanks for joining us again this year. I think the show just started, and that means you are the live beta testers for the presentation setup. So if there's a few bugs, I know they're still kind of getting everything worked out, so just bear with us. And hopefully we're good to go and roll. So this year we're talking about love for the unloved, or basically trying to find the good in game systems that people tend to write off, overlook, talk down. This was inspired in large part by my recent journey through the entirety of Virtual Boy's library, which I went into with some trepidation, and it actually turned out to be pretty good. I would say better on average than most systems I've played. I guess it wasn't around long enough to really have the stinkers come out. But in any case, that kind of got me thinking about, I think there is kind of this prevailing mindset online, not necessarily groupthink, but the meme gets around that a certain system is bad or that nothing it did was good, and that just becomes sort of the prevailing attitude for it. But I think it's worth stepping back, even for systems that genuinely were bad, and saying, like, what was good here? The people who created these systems and the games for it, they weren't out to create garbage. They wanted to create something good. They believed in what they were doing, or at least at some point in the creative process, they believed in what they were doing, even if it went wildly out of control at the end. Like, this is kind of how it happened with Virtual Boy. So let's try to find that nugget of goodness, that seed of inspiration that drove them to create this thing, and find what's good inside of that. I don't know if you guys want to speak up any about this particular topic.
Not until we get into the systems that we all picked.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you talk about games long enough, like in consoles and things, you sometimes have to sort of find what is good about, like, find the good console that's hiding deep within the heart of the kind of not so good. And a lot of times you'll see that the failures were just people who had the right idea too soon. And I think we'll see that with a lot of these.
There's a lot of business issues that, they had lots of great ambitions, but just because of funding or, again, coming too early, just collapsed.
Capitalism is the enemy of video game creativity. But no, I mean, even the great systems, the systems you love, the systems you have fond memories of, the NES, the Genesis, the Game Boy Advance, go out on that show floor, look in the bins of games, and you're going to find a whole lot of crap that you would never want to play. There's bad on the good systems, and there's good on the bad systems. So this episode, this presentation is focused on finding the good in the bad, and that is love for the unloved. And we're going to try to run through this pretty briskly, so anyone who has thoughts or opinions they'd like to share, we'll try to leave some room for that at the end. So if you could hold your feedback, comments, questions until then, that'd be awesome. But yeah, I think we're just going to kick it off. Kurt, if you would do the honors. I think you're hitting play there. There you go. Oh, so here we go. Virtual Boy. Oh, wow. Rob even put together a nice little breakdown of the Virtual Boy's stats. That's more preparation than I did for this show. So yeah, this was kind of the genesis of this whole panel topic, Virtual Boy. How many here actually have owned a Virtual Boy?
I have a broken one.
That counts. That's most Virtual Boys at this point.
Yeah, how many people's Virtual Boy is broken?
How many of you have actually played a Virtual Boy? Okay, so pretty much everyone at this point. So you know what you're in for when you play Virtual Boy. You know about the weird graphics and about the eye strain and about the fact that the system has warnings built in to say, please take a minute take a break every 15 minutes. The game Teleroboxer even has taking breaks built into the gameplay. If you don't take a break between rounds, then you don't gain back as much stamina for the second round of the fight as you do if you actually step away from the system and let your eyes rest. Your character actually also recharges. So, you know, even at the outset, this launch game, Nintendo was like, oh, yeah, there's some problems here. We've got to account for that. But at its heart, I think Virtual Boy was inspired by a few really good ideas. I don't know if you... You said your Virtual Boy is broken. Have you had a chance to play any Virtual Boy games?
Back when it was on display at Nobody Beats the Wiz, I was super impressed by, was it Red Alarm or Red Alert?
Red Alarm.
Red Alarm, just because it was 3D. And then there's a couple of games I played on emulators, like Jack Brothers, which is now, I mean, a lot of those are kind of like holy grail of collecting stuff. And it was a homebrew game. I played at a convention where they had a Street Fighter 2 port.
Yeah, Hyper Fighting.
Yeah, and that was
pretty.
There's
a copy of that out there for $1,200. I think they made 60 copies of that thing.
Yeah. At a convention, though, I was at in New Jersey. They actually had a little bottle of painkillers. This Virtual Boy medication. I almost bought one when KB was clearing them out because they were on the shelf like $30. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. And the only one I have is a broken one I picked up at a store that was going out of business. But yeah, I never played it long enough to get a headache.
Okay, well. That's probably the best way to experience it. Rob, what about yourself?
Yeah, so I did not have a Virtual Boy. I probably put my face on some dirty Virtual Boy kiosks in the day. I did have a friend who was really rich and spoiled, and so he got like one of everything when it came out, and he had a Virtual Boy, so I got to play it that way. I had to put up with his like insufferable younger brothers, but one of them threw a bagel at my face once. What is that?
It's kind of like the Virtual Boy experience. The bagel fighter. It really feels like there's a bagel flying at your face.
I must have liked the Virtual Boy because I kept playing. It was cool. Like I remember not having like strong feelings about wanting one, and I think that's probably what doomed it. Is not necessarily the like what we talk about now when we talk about like its problems, like, oh, you get headaches. So it looks weird. It's like, I think most people at the time weren't expecting something that was going to, I wasn't expecting Dactyl Nightmare. I mean, not something that, mind blowing. It wasn't mind blowing. If you haven't played Dactyl Nightmare, don't worry about it. But, it was just like, it wasn't like good enough. And like, we've seen 3D stuff. They used to run 3D movies on TV when I was a kid. So it's like, it really, just wasn't the same. I actually kind of liked the wireframe graphics, though, is what I remember about it.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Virtual Boy is it was sold as, the hint was there in the name of virtual reality, but that's not really what it was. It wasn't, it didn't have head tracking. It didn't have that kind of, spatial awareness. It was just parallax visuals. Basically, it took the red and blue anisotropic 3D that, showed up in movies and television in the 50s and 60s. And instead of making you wear glasses, said, let's build that into the system. So it gave each eye a separate display. And, basically the visuals on each screen were slightly different, and the differences created a sensation of 3D. And it's forcing your brain to see something that's not there. And that's why Virtual Boy can create eye strain and headaches. It's because it's forcing your brain to reconcile with an illusion that really doesn't exist and isn't real. But, it does sit in kind of this weird place. Like, it was supposed to be the next step forward. And when you sit down and play it, like I have with a video tap out to a television in grayscale, you're like, oh, this thing is Game Boy 2. This is 4-shade monochrome graphics, but in high resolution with a lot more processing power. And, I think if they had released the system, just ditched the 3D gimmick and released the system as a handheld that was like Game Boy Ultimate or something, it would have sold like crazy, especially if it was backward compatible and, people could still play Pokemon on it. But that's not what they went with. And, you know, the idea was to create something more of a virtual 3D space. And it does kind of evolve from that Nintendo attitude of let's take affordable technology, make something accessible to the public and give them an interesting experience that they couldn't have anywhere else for, you know, a fairly reasonable price. Although I guess you could argue that $179.95 in 1995 was not a reasonable price.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I think, one of the issues with it. It's just it was pretty expensive. And the other problem is it was really just kind of hard to sell it to people who hadn't seen it. So on the commercials, they have advanced 3D gameplay cannot be seen on TV. It's like it's really hard to sell that.
Yeah, it's like when you get nowadays, you know, HDR or 4K demos as a video on your computer. Like you're not experiencing the actual HDR or 4K on your computer.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and this is even more obvious because it's like it's supposed to be popping out at you and it won't because it's on TV and it won't even look like the game looks like because like part of the charm of the Virtual Boy is like actually also like one of my favorite systems, the Vectrex, which is just like the kind of weird flickery. I always felt like what the future was going to be like in 1982, you know, like that was cool. I mean, there were other things. I mean, just look at the difference in box art, right? Look at the American box art, which looks like
it's like the 90s threw up on you.
Yeah. And then like the Japanese box looks like it was designed by like Apple 2 years ago. It's totally different. But, you know, I mean, the other thing is like it does have kind of a toy like element to it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of rooted in. I mean, there were 3D goggles made for the Famicom.
Mm hmm. And for the Sega Master System.
Yeah. I think they both work the same way. They're like the flickering shutters.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have one of those, and I've never used it.
I have one of the Famicom ones. You can strap it to your head.
Yeah, I've never used it, but I should. I want to find out whether it works.
All right, but you know, we've kind of laid out the case for why Virtual Boy was kind of a mess. But let's talk about the good things that happened with the system. Like I said, it's a Game Boy successor in a lot of ways, and that means the library. If you kind of avoid the really bad games, there's a few of them out there. The good games really feel like, you know, they were successors to Game Boy. Like there's a fantastic Wario Land game that a lot of people know about. But there's also, as Kurt mentioned, Jack Brothers, which is a spinoff of the Shin Megami Tensei games. That is a top-down twin-stick shooter. It's not actually twin-stick, but it's twin D-pad. And that's another cool thing about Virtual Boy is it had this controller where they were thinking like 3 or 4 years ahead. This was before, you know, the dual analog, dual shock controller for PlayStation before the Xbox was even a thing. When they launched the N64, they actually took a step backward and had a D-pad and a joystick. And so when you wanted to play 3D games, you kind of use the camera buttons as an ersatz D-pad or controller. And it didn't work so well. But Virtual Boy had twin D-pads. And so games like Red Alarm, you were actually controlling the camera with the right pad, just like you do in a modern dual stick shooter. With Jack Brothers, you're moving in one direction with one pad, or moving with one pad in all directions and firing in all directions with the right pad.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about, we don't think about this, but the designers definitely had to think about it, which is that this is not just, you're not supposed to look at the controller when you play games, of course. This is a game where you cannot look at the controller because you cannot tear your face away from like the weird, like, you know, goggle thing that you put your face into. And so they had to make it so it's like impossible to drop. So it doesn't just have like wings on it. It's got like literal handles, you know, and they didn't make it too complicated either. I think that was why they used, you know, I think they were nervous about giving it too many buttons or anything like that. They just wanted to keep it simple. It was going to play like a Game Boy. It just had this extra little detail, and it turned out to be pretty forward-thinking.
Yeah, the very best Virtual Boy games either feel like an evolutionary leap for what came on Game Boy, or they feel like, games that were designed 10 years too soon and just didn't quite have the tech to support it. I mean, a big part of the problem with the system is that it was, you know, all about 3D visualization, but it didn't really have the processing power to produce 3D graphics. You could get the wireframes like in Red Alarm, but otherwise it was just sprites that were creating a parallax effect. So it just wasn't quite where it needed to be, but they put a lot of care into it. And, you know, some of the more esoteric games for the system, like V Tetris, doesn't really do much with the hardware, but it's just a really interesting take where they kind of said, Tetris and 3D, what can we do with that? That's not just like looking down at an isometric angle at the at the well. And so they actually give you like a well that rotates and you can move blocks around and create combos that way. Or virtual bowling, which is a super rare game that was released at the very tail end of the system's life in Japan. It's an amazing bowling video game. Like, everyone should play this bowling video game because it's really, really good. It's also $2,000, so you can't. But if the opportunity ever arises, play it, because it really, you know, it makes kind of straightforward use of the Virtual Boy hardware to give you a great simulation of bowling on a handheld system or tabletop system. I don't know that anyone was asking for that, but they, you know, like the creators for the system, they put their hearts into it and really cared. Even Galactic Pinball there, that was like the project that came for the Super Metroid team after Super Metroid. It's not a follow-up to Super Metroid, but a lot of the love and care that they put into Super Metroid shows up in this game, and it's a freaking great pinball video game.
It is Metroid canon now, too. So
that's true. Samus does show up.
Yeah. So I guess we can move on to the next one, right?
Anyway, that's my case for Virtual Boy. It's worth playing, but maybe don't spend $2,000 on virtual bowling. And definitely don't spend $2,000 on Virtual Lab because it's garbage.
Next, we have the Nokia N-Gage, which everybody remembers as the cell phone that could play games.
I remember it as talking.
The side talking, the taco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The taco. I always get this confused with the game.com.
No, sir. They are two different
things.
That
was much earlier, yeah. But the principle was the same. It does feel like a second take it because I think the whole point of it was like you can play online games, like online multiplayer on the world's ugliest cell phone.
At the time, there was all those like Java-based cell phone games, and they were more popular in Japan, and you could get them here. But their distribution was very weird. I remember at the time, like you could get a version of ETH. But you could either like pay for it once or they charge you monthly. And one time I got paranoid and just kind of deleted it from my phone because I wasn't sure like if I was going to get charged for it consistently. But this was normal. You would buy things on little cards and then stick them in.
Yeah, N-Gage was, you know, like mobile gaming these days is huge. And I think this was an attempt by a non-Japanese company to kind of say, well, you know, people like to play video games on their cell phones over in Japan. There's got to be something to that here. But instead of just giving you like the little simple flip phones that they had in Japan with very simple controls and simple games, they were like, let's make it a proper Game Boy Advance style game for hardcore gamers with 3D graphics. And man, it's a weird system. It is a phone, a cell phone, and also a game system. And I like this came out when I was working in the press already. So I actually reviewed a few games for N-Gage, and it never felt right. And I always felt like a weirdo, like sitting on the bus, you know, riding home playing N-Gage. I was like, are people laughing at me? I feel like they are.
It had a gamepad, which is nice, but the buttons are still just the phone buttons. It's not great feeling, especially since, I mean, it was competing with the Game Boy Advance at the time, but it did have 3D graphics.
It did. I remember playing one of the games I reviewed was Ashen, I think, which was a first-person shooter, and it was really hard to play a first-person shooter on that when you're, like, strafing with buttons that are right next to, you know, the forward movement and shooting buttons. It was a strange layout.
Could the N-Gage games use all of those buttons as face buttons?
I think most of them, yeah.
If so, it's like it's up there for like
the Jaguar.
Most buttons, yeah. With the Jaguar, like you could have every button. You could have done like a flight sim on that, really. I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't have been great, but yeah, check out that advertisement, by the way. Like, you guys think that the 90s, like really the 90s continued on into like well into the George W. Bush
administration. It took a while for them to go away.
I love that giant speaker peripheral I found. Like if you thought you looked like a dork on the bus with the note, you know, like imagine if you got this like, you know, it's like a jam box. Like that speaker is just, it's going to be like 3 inches away from your face.
I mean, it's like an update to that scene in Star Trek IV where the guy's just like blasting music on the bus. This is like Mr. Spock is going to pinch you for playing that.
Yeah.
The system, it did let you, like, it has a USB cable so you could put MP3s and stuff on it, which is still, like, a pretty big novelty back when this came out.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is, like, their impulses were not wrong, right? Like, at the time, like, as we've said, like, all over East Asia, like, people were playing tons of cell phone games. Those are huge money makers. And people played games on their phones here, too, but it was, like, you know, Snake or something like that. A lot of the stuff you get on N-Gage is just what people play on their like Androids and iPhones now. Like a lot of the earliest online, I mean, it even took a while, but they got there. It's got some weird stuff on it too. The Elder Scrolls. I did not know that there was an Elder Scrolls game on there.
There is, and it's remarkable that there was an Elder Scrolls game for Engage that was a, you know, proper small Elder Scrolls game, and they pitched, like, teased the idea of Elder Scrolls Travels for PSP for years, and that never materialized. So that's one up on the Engage over the PSP.
That looks like the best aspect ratio to play an Elder Scrolls game.
Yeah, they still had the vertical orientation, which is okay for the games that made use of it, but if you see like the Sonic Advance port that they did, like you either have to play it so that the view is very narrow, or it resizes it so the aspect ratio is like the Game Boy Advance, but just really tiny.
Oof. Yeah, an Ashen first-person shooter, you don't want to play one of those in vertical orientation. But still, you know, despite the fact that we've been kind of dogging on it, like Rob said, you know, the impulse there, the instinct there was really strong. Like, they were right. They just didn't go about the right idea in the correct way.
Like, that game Pocket Kingdom is actually an MMORPG made by Sega. And that was super cool at the time. Like, when I got an Engage, I didn't have the Silvers because I had my own cell phone, so I wasn't able to play the online stuff. It sort of seemed like, I guess, a Dragon Force or Ogre Battle type game.
Based on the screenshots I found, like, the people who were, I don't know, because it was made by Sega, right?
Yeah.
So the people who were translating this were just like, if you will get every single, like, early 2000s meme or joke is going to be in there. It looks pretty special. I don't know. It's one of those things, like, I don't think there's any way to play it now or ever will be again. And
it works. Like, I remember playing it offline. Well, I mean, playing it is that it ran. It didn't, you couldn't do much.
No, I mean, like, it's not going to be the same though, because just like all these MMOs, of course.
Well, you know, I think the Engage could have been successful with a different layout that didn't look so ridiculous. And also with, you know, mobile carriers that were designed around this idea. But, you know, like Kurt said, the idea of having to subscribe to an East game to be able to play it, that's strange, and that's just not how you want video games to work. That's worse than games as a service. That's video games as a disservice.
Yeah, the distribution never made a whole lot of sense. But as far as games here, like, the one that I do legitimately remember playing that never got ported anywhere else was that game Pathway to Glory. And it's a very XCOM-type strategy game that's set in World War II. And it's not, like, particularly advanced or anything, but it actually is pretty well done. Since it's entirely 2D, it doesn't deal with any of the clumsiness that all the 3D titles did. And there were a couple of RPGs that were done by Western developers that came out near the end of the system's life, which I was never able to find even when the GameStops were clearancing them out. But they're pretty well regarded. Rifts was one of them. They're based off of real pen and paper RPGs. Yeah, Rifts and Roots, Gates of Chaos. And they have the same sort of, like, isometric view lately. And they never were brought out for any sort of other systems either.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me also, like, how hard Nokia was pushing this thing. Because when you look at a lot of the games we're talking about, like, a few of them, like the Elder Scrolls and some others, like, a lot of the games came out for it, like, a year after its launch. So already when people were like, this thing is not doing well, we got to make it a less taco-shaped version. And they really were investing in it, and a lot, not just Nokia, but other developers, right, and publishers were really, they were smart to do it, to be honest, because it's like, it could have taken off, and it just didn't.
There was almost a Leisure Suit Larry game for it. That's not really a plus, but
is that what that threesome in the back of the cab was about? All right, why don't we jump ahead to Rob's first pick.
Yeah. So how many of you guys knew that Capcom made a console? Yeah, they didn't really. But what this is
it wasn't shaped like Capcom, so like the word Capcom, so it's hard to know.
You know, if that thing didn't start up and go, then there's a problem. But now what they did was they didn't really make a console. What they did was is they found themselves in like 1994, and they were going to transition to some new, you know, Street Fighter II had blown up big time, and they were going to transition to a new arcade hardware. So they had this, what was it, the CPS-1 board is what, like, everything from like Forgotten Worlds all the way up to maybe Street Fighter 2 Turbo were on, I think.
Right. I think they were already to CPS-2 by this point.
Yeah, they had already done, they'd done the CPS-dash for like four games. And then to do that, they made a like housing for it. And that's the first time that the CPS board would come in like a plastic housing that you could like plug into your arcade thing if you owned an arcade. But the CPS-1 boards didn't have that plastic housing. That's what all the CPS game, you know, arcades had after that. It was like much more modular. And I am trying to stall to find my notes. I close it for some reason. So they had this thing where we've got a bunch of extra CPS One games, and we've got hardware like we can encase those boards in plastic now. What should we do? So what they decided to do was to sell a system that was really just a thing. Like a, you guys know what a super gun is? Familiar with that? It's like a thing you hook up to an arcade board and you can play it on your TV. It converts like the JAMA inputs and outputs and et cetera. So they made a thing that would literally just clip on to a CPS One board. If you could advance to the next slide, you'll see it. So they just basically just drill. They screwed a plastic plate on top of these boards. And then that the console, which really had no hardware other than the conversion stuff to like output the video, would just clip onto it and plug into the pinout. And then they, if you got to look at that, the changer console, that thing, it had Super Nintendo inputs. And so what they did was is they sold this thing through magazines, and you could get a deal for like $700 basically. today you could get the Capcom fighting stick for the Super Nintendo, right? And then they'd give you Street Fighter 2 Turbo, just the arcade, literally the arcade. And then they'd give you the, you know, the thing to connect to it so you could plug it in your TV. And that was what it was. And it's like, it's not really a console at all. It's just an arcade and with a way of getting it on your TV. And they sold like, I don't know how many games I think they were just clearing out old inventory, to be honest. It was a pretty brilliant idea. I'm not sure how well it sold.
So I thought we were here to talk about bad game systems and systems no one likes, but this sounds kind of awesome. It's like Capcom's take on the Neo Geo, basically. I mean, being able to play these arcade games at home, it wasn't cheap, but like if you were into the kind of Neo Geo experience, this was the price you were going to be paying.
Right. Except the Neo Geo was designed to be made as a home console. So they, you know, the console was literally a console and you plugged the ROMs into it, right? This one, the cartridges were just the arcade boards, the entire arcade board. And they just had bolted stuff onto it so you could kind of make it work. And you can see how it wasn't designed because like the heat vents on the outside of the board are covered up partially by the thing you clip onto it. There's like a volume knob that you're supposed to be able to use if you're an arcade operator to turn that damn music down. And that thing doesn't connect to anything. So you can just spin it all day long and it won't do anything. Stuff like that. But the fact that you could get, like, if you loved Street Fighter and you wanted to have the ultimate Street Fighter, you could do that.
Or the ultimate Capcom arcade quiz.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. So, yeah, there's like, the games are basically just, you know, some CPS One games. And the only thing they did differently, they ported one game to it. They found a way to get Street Fighter Alpha to work on CPS One hardware. And I think they basically did that by cutting out some animation frames, pretty much.
So it was the PlayStation version to the arcade game's Saturn version?
Yeah, I mean, they managed to put Street Fighter Alpha games on, like, the Super Nintendo and the Game Boy and stuff. Like, they were pretty good at this. But, yeah, so it didn't have cue sound. I know I love Q sound, so it was in mono, which is also interesting because on the front there should be like a output on the front of the arcade board, or the back rather, for left and right channels for the Q sound, because the housing was made for the CPS Dash, which had Q sound. That was the first one, but those are just covered up. But they still labeled it left and right audio for some reason. So it's like it's really funny how MacGyvered up this whole thing was. But it's they did it. And they probably cleared out some of their warehouse, so good on them.
All right, so expensive and kind of goofy and maybe ill-considered, but still awesome?
I mean, I don't know how they probably didn't spend that much money on it to do it, really. So, yeah, it's pretty brilliant. And now they go for, like, thousands of dollars. So if you're a collector, it's, like, a pretty cool thing to have. But, yeah, that's about all I have to say about that one. I just found it pretty interesting. Okay, so
okay,
Jeremy's not talking about the GP32. I didn't know that. So this is about the predecessor. It's a
successor.
Yes. This is the GP32 came first.
Right. Okay. Why don't we back up just a little bit? So, this is kind of digging into the obscure. But about 2004, 2005, everyone was kind of trying to create portable handheld systems that could do lots of stuff. You know, the PSP came out and immediately people started hacking it to do more than it was supposed to be able to do. So the addition of this extra processing power in handheld systems over and above Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, Game Gear, that kind of thing, really sort of opened the doors to new avenues of creativity in the handheld space. And we kind of saw that with the N-Gage. You know, that would not have been possible with the GBA technology. But at PSP level, yeah, sure. So over in South Korea, you had a company called Game Park who wanted in on the action. And South Korea had kind of a weird, I wouldn't say weird, but complex relationship with video games, specifically Japanese video games, because after World War II, things weren't so good between Korea and Japan, and there was a law set down in South Korea that a lot of imports from Japan were not allowed in South Korea at all. And that includes video games. So Game Boy, Game Gear, Wonder Swan, Neo Geo Pocket, none of those systems ever made it to Korea. But, you know, Koreans still wanted to play portable games. And so Game Park kind of stepped in and said, let's do it. So they created the system, the GP32, and it was kind of, you know, like an interesting start. But the creators behind it had kind of a falling out when it came to following it up. And some of them wanted to go in a more 3D direction, like the N-Gage or PSP. And others said, we want to stick more with, you know, 2D gaming and kind of what you expect from handheld gaming, you know, from like Game Boy Advance and that sort of thing. So Game Park continued along and did its 32-bit 3D system, and they went out of business pretty quickly. But there was also a company spun off called Game Park Holdings, and they created the GP2X. And that was a really interesting system because it was, you know, kind of like a successor for 2D handheld gaming. It didn't look quite like this, but kind of similar. And it was also interesting because it could run operating systems, I believe Linux. Mm-hmm. And so immediately out of the gate, it was this really cool system for homebrew. And, you know, I imported one and kind of fumbled my way around. There were a few, like a handful, maybe eight legitimate releases. But basically, people were doing homebrew. They were creating emulators for GP32 or GP2X, games like Cave Story. I've played Cave Story for the first time all the way through on a GP2X, and it was a great little port to the system. So, you know, this is the very definition of obscure, because not a whole lot of people imported a handheld game system from Korea right around the time that DS and PSP were really gaining traction. Like, you know, if you have those systems, what else do you need in terms of the handheld space? But I was always interested in kind of like branching out and finding out what else is out there. And the GP2X was really, really interesting and had better emulators than the PSP. It had, again, you know, like some really great homebrew or conversions of free games. It had its share of piracy as well. But it was a neat little system, as long as you could handle kind of the complexity of dealing with a Linux-based interface and, you know, get things up and running. Tomax Save the Earth Again is a sequel to a PlayStation shooter that originated in Korea, where you are trying to save the planet and you play as a girl. I think it's like you're a potted plant, but you have a girl's head. I don't really understand it, but it's very interesting. It kind of is a cut from the Zombie Nation and like a cross between Zombie Nation and KO Flying Squadron. I don't know. It's really strange. But I don't know if anyone here has ever even touched a GP2X, let alone heard of it. But please raise your hand or give a shout or something if you have owned one of these or played it. All right. We've got a few brave souls who were willing to risk life and limb and money and play a weird little emulation system from overseas. But this never really went much of anywhere, and I think it was kind of soon supplanted by better solutions. But again, kind of like with the N-Gage, you really see here a company saying, let's push the limits of what you can do with a handheld system. And, you know, games like this and N-Gage were, or systems like this and N-Gage were really paving the way to what we have now in terms of mobile computing, mobile gaming, you know, with basically pocket-sized supercomputers that can play pretty much anything at this point. But it was the kind of like the step between, you know, Game Boy and iOS. It was weird things like GP2X. And so even though it really didn't do much of anything, never really went much of anywhere, I'm really grateful that it existed. It was an interesting experience and kind of an important but largely forgotten little step in the evolution of handheld games. I'm sorry, I've just ranted for like 5 minutes. Do you guys have thoughts?
I have no personal memories of this console.
I saw it at a digital press store once in the window, and that is as close as I've ever come to it.
I mean, it sounds cool. It's like, you know, it sounds like what, like, you know, owning a computer was like in the early 80s. Like, if you had an Apple II, like, that's what a lot of it was, is like people were just making cool stuff for it.
The sprite work on some of these games is pretty good.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What were they, ports of like other PC games or anything? Or
I think a lot of them were original.
Yeah, they look pretty good.
There were some attempts to bring PlayStation games to the system. Like, again, Tomac started out on PlayStation. But there were some original games, some homebrew. I think you're right. There were probably some PC ports. I didn't really delve too much into it because there was just not a lot of information about it on the English-speaking web, and I know zero Korean whatsoever. But, you know, it was a good way to play Cave Story, at least.
Yeah.
Taito X55, this is one of my choices, which I don't have a whole lot to say about because nobody can play this thing anymore. It's not actually a game console. It is a karaoke machine.
Hmm.
And the big advancement here is that it had a 9600 baud modem into it, so you would hook up to the internet and you would download a song. And it was tied in with Nami Amura, was one of the big J-pop stars at the time. She was in a commercial for it. Most of what I knew about it was based off of a Twitter thread from this one Japanese guy who made a game for it. The size of these things, since it was over a 9600 baud modem, that isn't very fast. So the size of these songs were, I think, estimated to be about the size of like a Mega Drive game, which is about, you know, 1 megabyte. And they figured, like, well, why don't we try to sell a couple of games over here? And there was a port of Space Invaders, which isn't particularly interesting. But they wanted someone there to do a Tetris clone. So the guy in charge of programming it, he created a game called Cleopatra's Fortune, which is this really neat little falling block puzzle game where you have to entomb things and clear them off the screen. And that game would have disappeared forever, except they ended up porting it to another system. They ported it to the arcades. And that's ended up on different compilations.
It's on Switch now.
Yeah, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool. It's a real big cult hit in Japan. Like, if you try to find physical copies of it, they're really expensive. But the PlayStation version came out even like a budget publisher for like 10 bucks.
Hmm.
And there's no onboard memory for it. So you would have to just download these games. And once we would shut them off, they would just disappear. It was very expensive. I guess on the previous slide, there's nothing.
Those
again
are the
about
two
this.
Images,
and like that, nobody knows what this old version of Cleopatra's Fortune looks like.
Yeah, that X, you know, you can see that homemade X55 logo that I'd put. that's just like, yeah, Georgia font. You know,
Italian. Yeah. Well, they would charge you, I think, like 10 yen for some amount of time to be able to play it. But once you shut it off, it'd be gone. And of course, the download service of this is, you know, gone for 2 decades. So it's just gone poof.
And you know, Taito didn't save this stuff, so it's gone forever.
Taito was actually in the process of making some other console that never went much of anywhere. They called, well, I want to say Wow Wow or something like that.
Yeah, that was like tied in with the Pippin Atmark too, wasn't it? No, yep. That was Bandai, sorry. I get my failed mid-90s consoles all mixed up.
Yeah, that was one crowded ship of fools there.
So again, there's not much to say. I just wanted to bring it up because I want more people to play Cleopatra's Fortune.
All right, well, Rob, hopefully you have more to say about your next unloved title.
Yes, I have a lot to say about this. Who has heard of the Zavix? Yeah. I see two people and other people getting ready to leave. So so the Zavix is actually, this came out, as you could see, in 2004, and it was basically the Wii before the Wii. So instead of using motion controls, like a motion control tracker, it had like infrared sensors, which kind of worked better in some ways and probably didn't work as well in other ways. It was invented. It was kind of like the brainchild of this guy who I can't remember his name. He's not super famous, but he did help create the Famicom back in the day.
Katsuya Nakagawa.
Yeah. So, okay. I feel bad now.
I just read it in your notes.
Oh, so. Yeah. My phone keeps going to sleep. But he kind of, the few interviews I was able to find with him, he seems like he was really disturbed by how he really took the family part of the family computer name seriously. And he thought this was going to, like, you know, all the family would rally around this and we're all going to play, like, you know, Mahjong and whatever. And it ended up being a thing where dad played golf sometimes and then the kids played Dragon Quest and never the twain shall meet. And he was really, it probably freaked him out a little bit because, you know, Japanese family rooms are small. So like if it's like it becomes this like isolated cave for like kids to play games in, and they disconnect from their parents and they're not going outside and playing. I mean, I think that bothered him. So he wanted to create something that was going to be easy to understand for everybody, that it wouldn't quickly get too complicated for adults and old people. And then that the family could do together and that would be active. And so he came up with this thing, and everything is sports. And the thing about it is that the, as you see, like that little square shape on the top of the console, to insert the cartridges, you have to push them down on that. It's like a platform. You push it down on it and secure them that way. And the reason why it's made like that is because most games would have an infrared sensor. And you'll see one on you kind of see one on the next slide. I should have done it better. You can see down like the lower left corner, or actually no, in the lower right corner where the fake bowling ball is. You see a little thing sticking out from the top of the cartridge. That's the infrared sensor. And so every game came with its own controller. So like kind of like it wasn't like a Wiimote in the sense that it's like one thing that is made to mimic other things. It's like many things. They're all skeuomorphic designs, right? So the tennis game had actual tennis rackets, and it would track your movements on the screen by the way that you moved the racket in front of the infrared sensor, which is pretty cool.
I'm looking at that bowling ball controller and thinking about, you know, people before the Wii wrist straps were mandatory, throwing their Wii remotes accidentally into their TVs and breaking their TVs. And I can only imagine the kind of mayhem that a bowling ball controller could have caused.
It would have been great if they would have made it like an actual like bowling ball sized heavy object and just like.
But, well, I mean, you've got it next to the console there. It's hard to judge scale.
Yeah, that's probably. I think the bowling ball is about like the size of a grapefruit.
That's a little disappointing.
The cool thing that they did with this, though, my favorite controller that they came up with is the baseball one, because you think this would be impossible to do, right? And yeah, you are kind of like flinging a thing and pretending to throw it, but you got to keep holding on to it. But what they did is that the way you select your pitches, it's got four buttons on the outside of the baseball, and you press down sequences of buttons or combinations of buttons that correspond roughly to the kinds of grips you hold when you're pitching a baseball. So I don't know what those are, but I'm just going to make something up and say, if you do like the outside two buttons, it's a curveball. If you do like the inside two buttons, it's a changeup or whatever. And that's how they did it. And that's a way. So like, you know, the player could select a play or, you know, not play, but select a pitch without telegraphing to the batter what he was going to do. So that's pretty cool. And the bat could probably really hurt people. It was a little bit short, but I can imagine that people got clobbered by that on accident. It had it, as you see.
They should have done like a Konami with their Famicom Konamics or whatever. The line they did with the inflatable instruments and weapons
smart.
And stuff. Not weapons, but sports utensils. What do you call things like a bat or accessories? Yes, that's it.
Yeah. I really want to know what the scale was all about. That seems like, I think it was just a straight up like health monitoring tool. So they weren't all fun, but the coolest thing they did is they got Jackie Chan's endorsement to put out two fitness games. And these games, I kid you not, you will get a workout. So he put out one that was called like the J-Pad, I guess for Jackie. And it was basically like a cross between the Wii balance board and the power pad.
This was before iPad. Well before iPad.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Did Apple rip this off?
Do you step on your iPad vigorously?
I do, but I don't know if that's recommended use.
Yeah, that would be an interesting game. But yeah, so they have one. So there's one that's kind of like it's the J-Pad, and you're just like kind of – it's, you know, bouncing. It's kind of like Dance Dance Revolution essentially, but with Jackie Chan talking at you at all times. Like, you can do it, like that kind of thing. But it will get your heart rate up. It is kind of like DDR in that. But the cool one is power boxing. The peripherals were boxing gloves. And the way it worked is you see it had an IR sensor there on top of the cartridge, and it was basically like punch out, and you would just move, put your gloves together like this to block, and it really worked. And then by doing that, you would dodge from side to side, and then you could just punch the snot out of these people. And this game just like boop, 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 and it tracked it. So you really felt like you were punching people. It is awesome. And I've never been able to find one to buy, but I really, really want one.
This sounds like they actually managed to do what U-Force wanted to do for NES, but completely failed at.
Yeah, it wasn't a lie. Like it's the IR tracking can be spotty, I think. But it, if you stand, if once you get used to it, it does work. And it works in ways that the Wii was only pretending to work. Unfortunately, nobody bought it. But you can see it came out just a few years before the Wii, and they really knew they had the market perfectly because Wii Sports was huge, and it's still huge in a way. Like, they're, you know, nursing homes, they're like buying up these old Wiis because the old people love them, and it's awesome. It's a great way to get people moving, and they had that, and it was one of the Nintendo guys.
I've never been trounced as badly in a video game as by playing Wii Sports Bowling with some elderly Vietnamese immigrants. Like, they annihilated me. They were like 70, 80 years old and just crushed me.
It's great. So in a way, like, he accomplished his goal. It just, somebody else ended up accomplishing it, but he accomplished it in that he cracked the code. He found what people would, and it just couldn't get it off the ground. The only other interesting thing about it is that it's like, although it came out in 2004, the games all look kind of like Super Nintendo games because it runs off of the same kind of processor. So that's all I have to say about the Zavix. But if you find one for cheap, you might really like it.
All right. We're running low on time, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. We got 15 minutes left.
Oh, 15. Okay.
Okay. So,
all right. Let's bring it on home here with my first computer, the Coleco Atom, which was... it was a very well-intended concept. It was kind of there was some parallelism here because the ColecoVision, which was the heart of the Coleco Atom, was basically the same hardware as the Sega SG-1000. And the SG-1000 had a computer version release called the SC-2000 in Japan. And this was basically the same thing. It was like, hey, let's take the processor of a console and turn it into a personal computer. And it's not a bad idea. You know, there were a lot of peripherals, like add-ons being created for systems. ColecoVision had, you know, different controller peripherals. Like, there was a big triangle. That was Coleco, wasn't it? The steering wheel and everything? Yeah. And then there was supposed to be an adapter that would let you play Atari 2600 games. It was tangled up in legal disputes for a long time. And this was also considered an expansion module. You could buy the Coleco Atom on its own, or you could buy a version that plugged into the ColecoVision you owned, which is what we had because these did not sell well and were discontinued at very cheap prices, and that's what we got. And that thing was huge. Like, you had what you see here, the big sort of the drive and console part, but then there was also the part that plugged into the ColecoVision. So it basically took up your entire desk, plus the keyboard, plus there was a printer that came with it. And it wasn't just a printer. It was like a huge daisy wheel. I think they had a dot matrix also. But we got the daisy wheel, which was less expensive. And that thing was loud. It sounded like there was a machine gun firing off as that thing typed out. Yeah. So there were a lot of logistical issues with it. It wasn't necessarily the best execution. I think it also had a lot of problems because... by default, it had a tape cassette drive as opposed to a diskette drive. And the tape drive was, by all accounts, better than the ZX Spectrum tape drive or something. Like, they loaded games in a couple of minutes as opposed to 20 minutes. So that's good. But the Atom, when it launched, when it booted up, sent out an electromagnetic surge that would erase anything in the tape drive. So you could not start up with anything in your system or near your system. You had to kind of move your tapes over here and then start up your computer. And then once it booted, then you could put your tape in and play Buck Rogers, Planet of Zoom or whatever.
That is so terrible.
Yeah. Like, this really, I mean, this came out around the time that the video games market crashed in America. And I feel like this was just kind of like dirt on the grave. You know, just that extra little grace note of finality. So this pretty much sank Coleco. Like, the company never really recovered from this debacle.
Still had that Cabbage Patch Kid in mind.
Yep. And, you know, it sold for, I think, $700. Was that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was not cheap in the early 80s. For, you know, a computer that basically would do what a Coleco or a Commodore 64 could do for you for half the price. So that's rough.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was pretty cool. I mean... you had higher capacity game cassettes than you have with cartridges. So they took longer to load, but they could do more. They could have more content. It had, you know, a lot of ColecoVision games. It could play any ColecoVision cartridge, for one thing. But then it had a lot of, like, super packs is what they called them, expanded versions of Coleco games. The best console version of Donkey Kong to that point outside of the NES, which wouldn't ship in America for a couple of years. yeah, lots of good stuff, lots of interesting arcade ports.
Dragon's Lair.
Yeah, I don't know about Dragon's Lair. Yeah. That's not a game that was designed to be played on any system that didn't have, you know, high-capacity media.
But they tried.
They did.
I just like the idea of getting Dragon's Lair on cassette. That just makes me smile.
It makes me sad. But yeah, like it was a maybe it's just memory, like nostalgia speaking, but I had some pretty good times with the Coleco Atom. It had a really great type tutor, which wasn't a game, but it had fun little musical jingles. It had art programs in the style of Mario Paint, many years before Mario Paint and that sort of thing. You could print out your creations on the Daisy Wheel printer, and it took about 20 minutes per page. And it was like filled the house with the sound of machine guns the entire time.
Yeah. It sounds like the G-Men so are coming for you.
I don't know. Good stuff there, in my opinion.
Do you know, really quickly, do you know if that Donkey Kong Jr. thing, did it have some kind of exclusive content?
I don't recognize that. I mean, I'm not a Donkey Kong Jr.
Where did that, screen come from?
That's the Coleco Atom Donkey Kong Jr. And it says, like, bakery level was what I saw in the caption. Like, I don't remember ever hearing about this, but there's, like, that's like a baking mixer.
I had that cassette. And I remember because it came, like, all their arcade super cassettes came in these really cool boxes. They were about this wide, that tall, and were shaped like arcade cabinets. So it was very memorable. Like, the cartridge sat in the body of the arcade cabinet. But I do not remember that level. If I played it, then it is completely erased from my memory.
Okay. So what do we want to do next? We got 10 minutes. Do we really
We can talk about the Nuon for a minute. The Nuon wasn't really, again, an actual console. It was a technology. It was a chip that they were going to try to stick into as many DVD players as possible. Sort of how the PlayStation 2 was both a game system and a DVD player. But they did not have the power of Sony behind them, so it died almost immediately.
The interesting thing about the Nuon, I think, is because it was non-standardized hardware, they had more controllers than games. Some of these controllers, I swear, are just Mad Catz controllers that were like had Nuon. Yeah.
I mean, that top left one, it looks like Sony went to the well for that, and we're like, PlayStation 3 controller, that's what we should do.
Yeah, I think that's the one I
battering.
Have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were 8 games from. One of them was only released in Korea, and nobody has any record of except outside of one guy. One of them only came with certain consoles. The only one anybody really care about probably is Tempest 3000, because some of the people involved in this were also involved with the Jaguar, including Jeff Mincher, who did the visualization for the thing. And since he was doing a visualization, he's like, well, I'll just import my old Tempest 2000 here and update it a little bit. And you know, at the time before TXK and Tempest 4000 came out, it was a little bit improved over 2000.
And that's what someone buys a console for, is a modest improvement over a game they already own.
Yeah. I remember here, I read something at the time. It was hard to mark these things because like people at the retail store didn't know what they were and would just stick them with the DVDs in a bin somewhere. So it was impossible to find these, actually. The other sort of interesting game here, which I've never played, is Free Fall 3050, which the guy who made it described as a combination of the, what do you call it, the parachuting parts of Pilot Wings with Quake.
So, you know, we got there eventually, right? And kids play games like that now.
And then some of these, like Iron Soldier and Merlin Racing, ended up getting ports later, which I don't think anybody was really excited about. But
yeah.
Okay, that's the new
one. All right. So can we close on this then?
Yeah, let's wrap on.
All right. So we've got 5 minutes to talk about FM Towns Marty. Let's have an FM Towns party.
have you been saving that up?
Actually, I think I heard Bob say it like years ago, and I have been saving it up. I say it all the time to myself. So the FM Towns Marty is the kind of successor to the FM Towns, which was a Japanese microcomputer. Did not have a lot of success. Computer was mostly kind of they were very frustrated because it had the education part of it took off in a way. And kind of defined the system, and the game stuff didn't. And so they tried to fix this. This is Fujitsu. Fujitsu made these. And so Fujitsu had been in the Japanese microcomputer game for a while, and I think this is the first like real console they did. Huge failure. I don't know what Marty means. I've looked everywhere. I cannot find an answer. They were incredibly expensive, and the controller had like 2 face buttons. I don't know what they were thinking. The interesting thing is that it was a CD-based console. It was released, in early 1993, so it was, you know, it made it. It had a mascot that I don't really know what's. I thought his name is not Marty. His name is Mr. T. All right, so mistakes were made. So the cool thing about it was, though, is that you could play FM Towns games, which is what I think most people who had one did with it. They eventually, because they wanted to release Street Fighter, they had to do, you know, it's like they didn't learn their lesson from the PC Engine or anything. It's like, okay, now we got to put out. Then, after they discontinued it, they decided, what else, how can we make this even less practical? And so somebody's like, what if we let people stick it in their cars? And so the car Marty was born. Fujitsu had an auto division, and what they wanted to do is they thought, hey, we're going to get on this GPS thing. And so they made a CD-ROM-based GPS thing out of the Marty. Now, as you can see, that gigantic screen, that was what your GPS. But it was also just a regular Marty, and if you wanted to try to plug it in your house, you could. On the next slide, you'll see what it was like to install the car Marty. So as you can see, the car Marty was not just – the Marty was the thing that read the CD and output the video. It came with like a one-handed controller that was just a Marty controller. You could use one hand, which is great because there are a lot of adult games that were released for the Marty eventually. And the GPS thing had to have its own GPS receiver, and it had to have the GPS kind of like – there's the receiver, and then there's the separate GPS box, which went under the passenger seat, was supposed to go there. And then there was this other thing that I don't know what it does, and nobody I've ever asked about seems to know what it does. And that also went under the passenger seat. The Marty unit clip was supposed to be somehow affixed to the central console in between the you know, where, you know, your armrest. And then you'd have to bolt the screen over somewhere. It was incredibly complicated, not sell very well, but they were very smart to have it was the first GPS system that had one way that could plot routes using one-way streets, which in Japan is a really big deal. So it had it didn't have a chance. It had a selling point that could have worked if they – and eventually, you know, GPS systems did do this. But the fact that they actually made a GPS system that was workable in that country is really cool. And these are incredibly rare, I just love talking about the FM Towns Marty.
Oh. Well, there's some games I know we were talking about before. There's some LucasArts ports.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And there's some adventure games. That was sort of the platform that you wanted to go to for American stuff. I think there's a port of Wing Commander and Wing Commander 2. There's also a bunch of Sega arcade ports, which were kind of not too bad. There was Galaxy Force. There was one arcade game that was lost for a long time called Last Survivor, which was sort of an early competitive game that it only kind of survived because there was an FM Towns ports of it. I don't know if it was Marty compatible.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do they have it out here at the console thing?
Yeah, they usually do.
I think I remember playing something. Afterburner 3, I think, originated as an FM Towns game.
It's not a bad console, but I think we can't really go any further with this one.
Yeah. So I think, we're going to wrap it up here. I don't think we have actually time for questions, but we'll be around. So bug us. Feel free. If you see us here at the convention, tell us about your favorite unloved video game system and why you love it.
How to Play Old Games.
I think that's the name that they gave it. I don't know if we gave it that, but if you're here for like a DIY, like how to do this thing, I don't know that we're necessarily going to be talking about that. It's more like what avenues are available for playing old video games. You know, obviously there's things like the Super NES Mini, you know, official systems like that, and there's computer emulation where you can find a ROM site and download games and play them in the gray market. But that's not really what we're focused on here. We're looking more at the ways to actually experience games, you know, more the way that they were intended by the people who created them, more in the environment in which they were designed to be played in. And so that's what we're going to be focusing on. I am Jeremy Parrish, one of the co-hosts of the Retronauts podcast, and I've got some extremely knowledgeable and talented people who are probably going to be more informative than me here. Guys, introduce yourselves.
I'm the talent. My name is Frank Cifaldi. I'm the founder of a nonprofit called the Video Game History Foundation. I also moonlight a little bit at a game studio called Digital Eclipse. We do classic game compilations through software emulation. And been a video game archivist for about 20 years now, which mostly means putting pirated stuff on the internet.
My name is Corey Carlson. I'm one half of the creative team behind a YouTube channel called My Life in Gaming. That does deep dives into console hardware, playing them on modern televisions, and like other game-focused episodes, playing different versions, different hardware, and so on.
And since Frank is the one who actually makes part of his living by making old video games playable for you, legally and otherwise, I feel like I'd like to have him start out and just kind of talk about the sort of the philosophical underpinnings of the work that he does. And you know, you've been very outspoken in recent years at places like Game Developers Conference about the fact that emulation is not inherently bad and it's not inherently inferior to any other, you know, format of playing games. It's all about the approach that's taken and the methodology used.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear you talk more about that in kind of this context.
Sure. And then also, I think what I'm also interested in maybe discussing, and we could bring this up later, is that what I'd like to discuss a little bit in this panel is when we say how to play old games, I don't think that's necessarily just like what is our physical setup for playing old games. Like, I think there's also sort of a mental component to it. Like, how do you approach playing old games? You know, like what kind of mindset should you be in? Should you approach them like, you know, watching an old black and white movie and then appreciate them for what they are as opposed to what they were, I should say, as opposed to what they are now.
Yeah, yeah. If you boot up an NES game looking for gacha or loot boxes, you're going to be really disappointed. You're going to have to let go of those things and have a different experience.
But, yeah, to your point, like I've done a lot of work with Digital Eclipse to present older games in the way that I feel they should be presented, that we do at the studio, I should say. Which is that for a lot of older games, they're not really that good. You know, like you can't just kind of plop like a random old NES game in front of someone and like especially younger generation that didn't like grow up with these things and have them understand out of the gate why this is fun and why I should care. The approach that we take, I like to say that we make like coffee table books about the games, but they're digital and you read them with a controller, as opposed to like collections of old games. So we've done four now. I'll just list them because in case you guys have played any of them: Mega Man Legacy Collection, Disney Afternoon Collection, Street Fighter 30th Anniversary, and then SNK 40th Anniversary. They're older than Street Fighter. we did not do Konami 50th Anniversary, which we had though. And the way that we tend to approach these is that we contextualize the games so that you understand their place in the world and what they were at the time and why they were important. So we do a lot of sort of behind-the-scenes stuff to tell you what the creators were thinking and, you know, concept art galleries and things like that. And then, you know, that I've done two GDC talks. Like if you want 2 hours of me going off about this stuff, please look them up. They're probably good because they're pretty popular. A lot of what we do is also, and this is a whole topic, but interpreting how people played games at the time and translating that to modern language, right? So like, for example, in SNK 40th Anniversary,
we did a lot of SNK's arcade games where they use what's called a rotary joystick. I don't know if any of you guys have played. Ikari Warriors is probably the most popular, the arcade game, not the NES one. I see a lot of nodding. It's probably for the NES one. So you played the arcade one. So you probably remember that the joystick, you know, you tilted it to move, but you twisted it to aim, right? Yeah, you played it too. And, you know, on a modern controller, there's no, you can't like, well, you probably could twist the Switch stick, but you'd break it. and it wouldn't help you in the game. So, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about, like, well, what was the intent of the original creators and how can we best translate that to a controller? And then we spend months working on twin stick support that should never have been in that game but works miraculously. That's enough from me for now.
All right. Well, I will say that I feel like the work that I do that's relevant here is kind of similar in philosophy to what Frank does, but from a different perspective, whereas he's sort of unearthing games and the history behind them to present them to you so you can play them and experience them. I'm kind of on the outside and can't really do that. So I have a podcast, Retronauts, about classic gaming, and I also have been producing a weekly video series called Video Works or Retronauts Video Works or whatever you want to call it. But basically I've been going through the libraries of various systems. Right now it's been Nintendo, but hopefully someday I'll branch out. But Game Boy, NES, Super NES, Virtual Boy. And the idea there is, you know, I don't have a whole lot of insight into the developers. I don't have access to the people who made a Game Boy game 30 years ago. But what I do attempt to do with these series is to talk about the games and then place them in the context of when they were first published, when they were first created and released. So, you know, you may go back to, say, Super Mario Land on Game Boy, and that's not a very impressive-looking game, especially compared to later Mario games that came along on the same platform compared to Super Mario Land 2, Six Golden Coins. Super Mario Land is kind of primitive and janky, but you have to understand that this was, like, the first, you know, Game Boy game ever. I mean, along with Alleyway and Baseball, it was created when the idea of portable gaming was brand new, almost. You know, what had come before that was much more primitive. It was LCD handhelds, and it was things like Microvision or Game Pocket Computer, which were far less powerful, far less capable than Game Boy. So, yeah, Mario Land doesn't look that great, but it was a 12-stage Mario game with pretty good controls and fairly accurate physics, although the ball thing is weird, and kind of strange enemies, but still recognizable. Like, it gets the Mario experience across, and if it feels alien and strange now, well, yeah, but when it came out in 1989, we weren't like, oh, this is a very strange take on Mario. Why is he so small? Why is he shooting balls? Instead, we were like, wow, cool, I've got Mario, and I can take him in the car or on the bus or on an airplane. I can, you know, when I have to go to grandma's house for a week and you know, spend a week in the woods or whatever, I can still play Mario because here he is on Game Boy.
And it wasn't really much of a Mario canon yet, so it's like, okay, he fights lions now. I'm
yes,
good.
especially in the U.S. where we had Super Mario Brothers, then the American Super Mario Brothers 2, and then Super Mario Land. We didn't have Mario 3, we didn't have Japanese Mario 2, so there wasn't that sense of continuity. It was like, it's Mario, he jumps, he like shoots stuff, that's pretty much good enough. So yeah, maybe he's in a submarine, why not? and you know, I think it's important to have that recognition, that context, the understanding of what games were like when a game was created and, you know, what had come before it to lead up to that point, to really understand why this was good or why maybe even at the time we were kind of like, oh, I don't know about this one. And, you know, what kind of knock-on effect it had throughout game history. So that's the approach that I take. And so, yeah, that's not really how you play games, but it's sort of why I play games and what I want to impart through my work.
I guess we kind of focus on the various ways to play these games and, you know, alternatives for, you know, between emulation, real hardware. And that's one of the things that we think about. Like, we tend to focus on official emulation options. I mean, I know there's a lot of emulators out there that do certain aspects better than others. But we think it's more interesting to look at what the developers themselves, like what they chose to, how they chose to do it themselves, or they hired somebody like Frank to emulate these games in the best possible way. You know,
not typically the goal when they release release these old games.
Right. Well, they want to make it as good as they can. Yeah. But I mean, I'm sure there's like people developing these emulators that, you know, squeeze some extra stuff out in different, like you look at Dolphin or something like that, you know, that's doing a lot better than, you know, something you'd see, the Wii compatibility on the Wii U.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, we tend to look at stuff like that. But mainly we focus a lot on, real hardware, just like different revisions of hardware. Their capabilities in outputting it to different displays, but also how can they be modified to give them enhanced abilities, such as, you know, HDMI output and 1080p. And
I'm kind of interested in pivoting from here to like, why are we playing on original hardware?
Yeah, that was going to be my suggestion too. Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, if you want the true NES experience, go out there, buy a Nintendo Entertainment System, buy a game or two, and find yourself an old tube television, get yourself an RF adapter or maybe composite cables if you're feeling fancy, and there you go. That's the authentic experience.
Climb back into your mother's womb.
Yeah, exactly. That's not really realistic or practical. Those old tube TVs, are very few people make them anymore. They're hard to find. I don't think they really sell new ones in America anymore. You have to go to China or Korea.
And even then, they're just made, they're garbage.
Poor quality, yeah. So, you know, why would you do that? Why, there are other options available. But at the same time, there is a value to the original hardware itself, because that is the machine that these games were being programmed for.
Is that why you play on original hardware?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to say that I only play on original hardware, but if I am recording footage, I prefer to record on real hardware, because that is the authentic experience. It's going to run exactly the way that it was meant to run, it was designed to run. And I mean, that's a big part of it. If I am sitting down to play a game, like I want to play the original version. And I don't have much of a problem putting myself into the mindset of the time that it was made and like certain shortcomings of that time. And, you know, some people say, oh, these games have aged terribly. But at the time, like, they were basically just doing what they could to make them as playable as possible. And
what I was going to say is that, you know, I work in commercial emulation, right? Mm-hmm. I have been a proponent of emulators since I discovered them in the late 90s. You know, like, the bulk of my having played old games has been through emulation, but I do maintain old hardware on a Sony PVM. You know, I'm one of these RGB fetishists, like all of us here. and that's maybe when I sit down to like capital P play a game. That's mm-hmm. how I play a game. And I think for me, it's just I don't see an inherent you know, disadvantage to using emulation necessarily. It's that that emulation is like 99.9% accurate, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just I like the peace of mind of knowing that, you know, what I'm playing is like actually completely accurate,
right?
You know?
Right.
But like that for almost everybody, that shouldn't matter. You know, there might be a random error in like Speedy Gonzales on the Super Nintendo or something, but then the rest of the library is fine. Mm. You know, and
most people are not going to think about it,
right?
They just want the easiest way to access and play that game.
And I think something that frustrates me is that it almost feels to me sometimes, and this might just be me, that like there's this kind of weird gatekeeper aspect in the community sometimes, where it's like, oh, you're not playing on the real hardware, you're not really playing the game, right. And I don't like that. I don't think anyone should have to maintain antique hardware to play the game for real. I think that emulating a game gets you the real game, and that there's nothing wrong with that. And I recommend that should be your gateway into old games if you want to go exploring that old stuff.
Which is like one of the main reasons why we position ourselves as we don't give you a definitive answer. You know, we say here's your options. Play in whatever way works for you. You know, you can make this choice, and here's everything just laid out.
Yeah, I mean, what does the word authentic even mean in this mm-hmm. context? Like, I have no intention of telling other people how they should play a game. If they play a game and they enjoy it, congratulations, you've done it right. I would never recommend someone use like one of those At Games mini Genesis systems that have been coming out over the past decade. Like, those are a genuinely bad experience, but people buy them and apparently enjoy them, so that's okay.
It's good enough for them.
But for me, the pursuit of like a good, quote unquote, authentic experience has been much more personal, and it's because, you know, ever since I discovered emulation back in like 96, 97, whenever that was, I thought it was really cool, and I've played emulators and games on emulation, but it just never felt quite right to me, and I never really figured that out. And I think it was the changeover to HD television and flat panel TVs where I kind of had this like watershed moment. And you know, I would plug in an NES or I bought one of those twin Famicoms in Japan that has, you know, the built-in Famicom disk system and the cartridges, and I was like, this is awesome. I've always wanted one of these. This is so cool. And I plugged it into the TV, the flat panel in my hotel, and immediately jumped in to play Doki Doki Panic. I was like, finally, I'm going to play Mario 2 the real way, the way it was intended by Miyamoto-san. And it was awful. It was a terrible, terrible experience. And it's not because the game was terrible. It's not because the system was terrible. It's because the way that system talked to the flat panel TV was not good. And it created, you know, it like smeared the graphics and stretched them out, and it created this like significant delay in responsiveness on the screen, so everything was out of sync with what I was doing. And for a while, I was like, maybe I'm just over old games. Maybe I've outgrown them, and I don't like them anymore. And it was a few years later when I think you were at 1UP with me at the time, 1UP.com, in the offices. People were given offices, and I was given an office that was actually a storage closet, and that was still okay because, you know, I had an office. And there was this really huge...
I had a cubicle.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to rub it in. It was a seniority thing. I'd been there for a long time in my cubicle, and I got a storage closet. But there was a huge CRT television that was going to be thrown out, and I said, actually, you know what? Stick that in my office. That's going to take up like half my office, but that's okay. I'm going to slap a Super NES on there, and anytime someone wants to come in and play an old video game, they can come in my office and sit down. So for a while, we were just like, you know, every afternoon people would come in and we'd play Yoshi's Island or whatever. And playing on that, you know, that TV on original hardware, that was a really different experience than the flat panel experience that I'd had with Doki Doki Panic. And that kind of made me realize, you know, like, there is a difference in this technology. And I didn't really pursue it for a while. But, you know, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, I started thinking, you know, I'd wanted to produce video content, and basically just settled for the most convenient capture setup I could, which was one of those like portable Super NES emulators, and I plugged a Super Game Boy in. It sounded terrible. The video quality was bad. The audio was like staticky and distorted. And someone wrote to me and was like, you know, I'll give you some equipment that's better if you will stop doing this. So that was the point at which I said, wait, okay, so it is possible, you know, through these devices, through upscalers and that sort of thing, and RGB cables and mods, to actually play these games on an HDTV and still have that kind of, you know, that experience I remember from the NES days, from the Super NES days. And so that kind of set me on this horrible self-destructive spiral of trying to find the best possible ways to play as many consoles as possible and also be able to capture them in high fidelity, which it's been a long and expensive road, but it's come a long ways, and I feel like I can stop now, soon.
I'm impressed that you can say you can stop.
Yeah, well, I've never heard anyone say
it doesn't end.
I say that to lie to myself. Because if someone comes up with like a video app mod for WonderSwan or Neo Geo Pocket, then yeah, maybe. And there's like a consoleized MVS that's coming out soon that has like HDMI output. Okay, the Behar brothers, I think, are making that. I'm probably going to buy one of those. But like in my heart, I feel pretty complete. But it took like a decade to get to that point.
I'm envious.
So where are you in your quest of doing probably the same thing?
Well, I mean, it's become such a thing that it's relaxing just to sit there and see how I can optimize stuff. And yeah. I probably spend more time tweaking and optimizing my setup more than I do even playing games a lot of times. And if I have some downtime, I'm like, how can I reroute this so I can I'm using less wires? Which, you know, it's always something. It's always something. You know, I have several systems, and now I even, you know, I have an extra switcher now that I can have multiple revisions of the same system hooked up, so I can easily, you know, instead of unplugging them and plugging something else in. It's stupid.
That sounds like a dark road.
Yes. But, you know, I had extra space in my racks. I'm like, what am I going to fill the space with? Might as well put in, like, you know.
Gold Star 3DO.
Like a launch model Super NES and a one chip. You know, I can easily, and I'll hook up one of them in component. The other one will be RGB.
Mm.
It doesn't end. And,
so
you know,
it's like having a shack next to a mansion, basically.
Basically, it's all in my attic, though. You know, I have so many CRTs and stuff up there. I mean, my wife is like, no more. Like, if I see another one come up here, it's over. And it's like I have to carry up three flights of stairs. And so I only try to take things out if I can.
So I tried for a little while to have just a setup where everything just works, and I did okay. I have a TV cart with my RGB monitor. Inspired by Bob. I don't know if he's in here. Like, yeah, Bob had like a cart on his site. I was like, oh, that's a good idea. And, you know, I just kind of have like the six systems that I might actually play in there. And then every time I try to stream, like, I just kind of reinvent the wheel and have to rewire everything. And I just gave up on having a setup where everything just works. But I have a TV and I have, you know, a way to plug in power and RGB. So, like, if I'm really going to play something, it'll take me a minute to hook it up. Yeah. And I discovered pretty quickly that it's like, all right, I have them all hooked up. I can play whatever I want. I don't want to play any of this, actually. But, but you know, I discovered that pretty quickly. And so, like, I don't know. Like, I think I've come around more to just, like, if I'm actually going to sit down and play a game for more than an hour, I can invest the 5 minutes setting that up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh yeah.
And that's fine. I can just grab the system out of the shelf or the garage or whatever and do it if I'm really there. But a way I really like to play these old systems, though, I call it channel surfing. And, you know, we all use flashcards here, right? Or we're not pretending that, like, I mean, we have the complete libraries that we've legally backed up, of course, and then, but
sure. My complete selection of Virtual Boy games, including the $1,000 cards.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you delete the ROMs every 24 hours.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And then re-download them.
No, you re-rip them.
Oh yes, sorry.
You can't download it. And a way that I like to play is to just kind of, like, you know, put in the Super Nintendo EverDrive or whatever. I guess I don't even have to do that anymore because the Super NT just has the SD card thing. And just kind of like, what's the letter G have? You know, and just start, like, exploring. And I like playing old games that way because you can't play new games that way. You know, you can't jump into a game quickly and, like, start, like, laughing at it.
Yeah, I mean, you can be, like, through the one stage of Mega Man 2 by the time, like, copyright indicia on current game fade out in your login screen. You're, hey, you have to be logged into Bethesda.net to be able to start this game.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that in an old man way. Like, it was better. Remember the times when you turn on the system and there was no updates. Like, I don't. That's games are so much better now. But that is a different kind of playing that I like to do that I can't get with modern games. It's just like loading up some garbage and looking at it.
That's interesting because I feel like if I have a whole list of games, like, I don't spend any time, like, dedicated to one game.
Sure.
You know, if I'm going to really sit down and play through a game, like, I want to play, like, on my original cartridge, because that's, you know, I've paid money for that, and I have an attachment to it. I've committed to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the flashcard is great for, you know, I'm going to get a quick clip from this game or this game. But I will never, like, just sit down and play through an entire game that way. Because I think that in a lot of ways, having access to this huge list of games has given the idea that certain games are worse than they are, because a lot of people will say, well, play One Life and, like, oh, this game sucks. Like, it's way worse than I remember it being. Then they'll stop, move on to something else. And then they'll go on the internet and say, you know, this game, it's horrible. You know, and I think that they will, without really committing to it, just say that it's bad.
Mm-hmm. I noticed someone's filming this this piracy discussion. You're not a cop, are you? Okay. Just making sure it's all good.
You can film. It's okay.
It's fine. I'm just kidding. Yeah, you know, for me, the
having access to this alphabetical list of every video game for a system has other benefits too. My I have a nephew. He's about 9, 10. He loves, you know, current games. Like, he loves playing Pokemon, Minecraft. He loves Undertale. And he's actually kind of gotten into sort of retro-style games because of Minecraft. He sees them, and he's like, oh, that looks like Minecraft, except it's flat. So he loves to just come over, and, I mean, he loves, you know, Zapper games, playing those on a proper CRT and shooting ducks or criminals or whatever. But he'll just, like, sometimes he'll just say, I just want to play a game. And he'll scroll through a list, and he'll find a game that sounds interesting. And it's maybe something I've never played. Like, one time he booted up Mystery Quest. I was like, oh, so this is what Mystery Quest is.
And, you know, and I can visualize the box, but I have no idea what
the
game is.
Yeah, it's like a little platformer.
Neat.
So anyway, like, that's a great experience. You know, I'm learning new things, and he's kind of, I think, appreciating the value of having these old games. But, for myself, when I try to acquire as much as possible complete-in-box old games, just to document them and put them into my videos and then into the books that I create out of those videos, so that, you know, there will be like a printed record of what all these games complete in box look like and what their cartridges and manuals look like. But I don't want to keep hundreds of games. I don't have space for that, and I don't have the interest. So I'm like, okay, I photographed it. Now it's on. And, you know, if it's a game that I can't play through some other method, you know, if it has a special chip or something, or like the game Robopon for Game Boy Color has like rumble and a real-time clock and an infrared sensor, and it does not work on flashcards because of all this crazy crap that they crammed into the cartridge. And that's fine. Like, I'll keep that cartridge. That's interesting. But otherwise, like, I don't have too much... I don't place a lot of, I guess, stock in owning a thing just to own it. I have a collection of games that I keep for sentimental value, but I'm much more concerned about the actual hardware. And, you know, the way that interfaces with televisions and the way that I interface with it through that, you know, kind of the experience that creates. And I'm not honestly hung up on original hardware. Like, field programmable gate array systems, those are pretty awesome. And I feel like I kind of stumbled into this whole obsession at just the right time, because I started, you know, getting serious about playing old games in the best fidelity possible right around the time that Analog started producing systems. And their first Analog NT was kind of, it was an interesting idea, but not producible in the long run. But the Mini that they produced is maybe the best system that I own or have played. It's so versatile, and it's very, very accurate. It has digital out, so I can plug it straight into an HDTV, and it has analog out, so I can plug it into a CRT. And I can play it either way, and it's a great experience, and like, that has become a mainstay of my recording setup. It's just such a great device. I would love for them to make more of those, because now they're selling for thousands of dollars. And they're great, but maybe not worth that much money. But it's something, I feel like there should be access to that for everyone. But the 16-bit systems they're doing, the Super NT and the Mega SG, those are also great, and they keep getting better with new releases for firmware and jailbreaks and things like that. And I have no qualms about playing games and you know, capturing quote-unquote reference quality material footage from those systems, because they're very, very accurate. Maybe not 100%, but like, I can't think of too many experiences where I've been like, oh, this doesn't feel right. It's a great alternate opportunity. And I feel like these things are going to be a lot more durable and sustainable than trying to play on 30-year-old hardware. Like, NESs, you know, those are 35 years old now, and it's hard to find them. You have to like refurbish them and, you know, mod them. And
like you said earlier, if you just plug them into your modern TV, it just looks like smeary garbage because it's not meant for that. You need to scale that image before it looks correct. But I mean, yeah, so, you know, what Jeremy's talking about, FPGA based approaches to essentially emulating the software, it's rather than recreating an old system like a Nintendo entirely in software and putting it on a computer, essentially, an FPGA approach is to, God, it's so hard to explain this. it's essentially like having the hardware itself physically alter itself to behave more like that original system. The way I always describe it is like nano machines go into a computer and move all the gate arrays around until like it's a Nintendo. And so there's been some commercial systems that do this, like Jeremy said. There's been from Analog, I think entirely. Has anyone else done a commercial?
No,
yes.
I think.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, the retro USB AVS is another.
Right. Yeah.
And that's a great entry point into actually NES and HD. It's the one I recommend most. And it's a really good way of playing these old games because the original cartridges just work. And you know, sometimes people just, I mean, like you have this a little bit where it's just like it's somehow like a more holy experience if it's the real cartridge, right? So like it offers that, but then also you know where to look on the internet. You can root the thing and just load ROMs into it, which I love.
Yeah, and there are a lot of sort of DIY solutions, kind of up and coming. Mister is really the big one, and that's growing in capabilities and power basically every week. And that is, you know, it's kind of like the equivalent of MAME, but in simulated hardware. The thing is, it's not just like a plug and play solution as opposed to the analog stuff.
Right.
So you really have to be kind of committed to making it work. But if you're willing to take that on, it's a powerful and capable system that can do things no other console can. So definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, a definite learning curve on it, though.
Yeah,
for sure.
What I like about these from a preservation, well, Mr. Project specifically from a preservation perspective, is that people who are writing new system cores to work on the Mr., like, I don't know, the Atari 800 computer or whatever, right? Like, they're almost like revisiting documenting that hardware and making sure that it plays accurately. I think there's this sort of belief that like once a system was emulated, it's like we're done, it works. But it's like no, the idea of replicating this physical thing in a digital way, like it's a forever pursuit. There's no perfect. I mean, there is a theoretical perfect, but like not in our lifetime. So I love that people are revisiting this hardware, redocumenting it, and doing it in an open source way that is maybe sustainable forever. Where you know, even if all the boards that run Mister just like disappeared, like Thanos from the world tomorrow, it's like if we have the software documentation of what those cores were, like we could recreate that hardware in theory. Mm-hmm. And I really like that about Mister and like the main project and stuff like
and
that.
And it gives you the option for like analog and HDMI outputs for video. You can do both at the same time. You can play on a PVM and capture over HDMI.
Have we all done that?
I mean, my kind of come to Jesus moment with all of this was back in, I would say, 4 years ago. I was wanting to launch an NES retrospective video project, you know, to coincide with the 30th anniversary of the NES launch. So that would have been 2015. And you know, if you take the NES in chronological order, pretty quickly you get to games like Gyromite and Duck Hunt that require accessories that only work with CRTs. I mean, there are people who are working on solutions to make those work with, you know, flat panels, but it's, you know, it's still kind of early days on that. But the thing is, like, the you know, if you want to upscale video and capture it in digital, like making that possible while also still outputting to a CRT television where you can actually use the light gun or ROB or whatever, that was really challenging. And I spent months and a lot of money trying to tinker with different ways to make it work. And my initial solution was to, you know, have a modified NES and run video into a Sony PVM professional video monitor that has high-end video inputs and also has pass-through. So it'll feed a signal into the television. You can see the signal, and then that signal will be sent out. And then from there, you can upscale it and record it and send it to an HDTV or whatever you want to do. So I'd be able to record. But that's not a perfect solution because the video signal loses a lot of brightness and kind of quality in the process of being passed through. So the output was kind of janky. I was still like really proud that I made it happen. It was like, I feel like I, you know, accomplished something. So I got, you know, maybe the first HD capture of Gyromite and StackUp on the internet, which is actually not that great an accomplishment. No one really cares, but I was still proud to have done it. But then, you know, the analog NT Mini came out, and that has the analog output. And around the same time, the GS Card SW, I think that's what it's called.
The G-SCART.
Yeah.
G-SCART Switch.
G-SCART Switch, okay.
Like
So that's like a video switcher where you can plug in, I think, 8 different devices and have it output, but it has dual output. It has VGA and S-card. So I was able to like send one signal from that to my PVM, and then the other output goes to my HD setup. So I wasn't losing any of the luminosity or anything like that. And I was getting even better signal quality. And that was when I realized that this was over my pay grade, and I really am kind of out of my depth, but I made it happen somehow. And honestly, RetroRGB was a huge help. If you have never been to that site and you're interested in this stuff, like, go there first, because it breaks everything down for you. And there's so much to worry about when you're dealing with analog standards, because, you know, in addition to the different kind of hookups, there's also different kind of video sync. I don't even want to get into it. It makes me, like, my head is actually hurting just thinking about it right now. But, you know, these are the kind of obstacles you have to overcome if you have some sort of weird obsessive project like I do. And, you know, the end result is that I can sit down and plug and play an NES game or a Super NES game and, you know, use light guns and things like that and record into my computer and create videos out of it, which is really cool. But the process of getting there, it's daunting.
Much easier now than it used to be, though, especially
yeah,
since
absolutely.
There's so much information out there.
If I had tried to do this, you know, 10 years ago, I don't think it would have been possible.
Yeah.
Well, and everything you guys are talking about is to capture for content that you create, right?
Yes. Like, right.
Absolutely. That's a huge part.
Do not do this for fun.
Yeah, there's no reason to play games on a, you know, a CRT and record it in HD unless you're doing some sort of project, like,
right.
you know, for public dissemination or for archival research or something. But otherwise, like, we're creating a lot of steps for ourselves, a lot of pain that you don't need.
Yeah, I used to do exactly that when I would stream old games with my wife. Like, we liked playing on the Sony PVM. It's like our child. And we would... What we ended up doing was getting a good RGB splitter from, I think, Shinybo. So it was, like, one in, two out. Mm. And that didn't lose any of the luminosity or anything.
Oh, okay.
So we went into the
I made
TV.
It more complicated for myself than I needed to, I guess.
You can't like Google like RGB splitter and like good results, you know. Like I understand. That was a lot of like forum trawling, I think, until I came up with that. But yeah, we would do the same thing. We'd go straight to the TV with one, and then FrameMeister to capture card in the other. And like I wasn't even looking at like we didn't put it in a TV or anything. It was just like it just looked nicer to stream in HD while we played in SD. So we did that for a while. But again, like it. None of this matters. It's just like weird pursuit of perfection sometimes that I think we all get trapped into, and I'm very guilty of it myself. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when we're even talking about like the analog consoles, and it's like, oh, it's spitting out in HD, it's perfect. So I'm like, no, it's not perfect, because actually, and you know this, you know where I'm going with this. It's like if you're scaling like an NES game to the exact like pixel aspect ratio that it was meant to be on a CRT, those pixels, no, they're not 1:1. They're 8 wide, 7 tall. So yeah. To get like a completely accurate pixel aspect ratio, you're actually scaling that thing beyond 1080p, which these things don't even do. So even that's not accurate. So like they're like it's like, you can go down this rabbit hole forever. Mm-hmm. Or you can just emulate the things perfectly on a 4K monitor. But
I mean, even emulating, you know, you learned over time that to get that on a like a higher resolution, you know, the emulators have to be able to like interpolate the image, you know, so that when the screen scrolls, you know, if some pixel columns are wider than or may have more are wider
right,
than
if,
others,
if you're,
and you'll get this weird like we call it shimmering, but it's kind of like a Boeing or whatever, it looks bad when it's
screwed. It's kind of like a centipede moving where it's like the back edge of pixels kind of like fall behind and then catch up, but really really fast.
It's like
a really
almost,
fast centipede on your screen.
Yeah, it's kind of like shaky. I don't know how to describe it, and don't go looking for it because you can't unsee it. But yeah, to your point, it's like that's when you know some like. Commercial emulation packages or some systems. I think the NT Mini does no interpolation.
Right.
Yeah.
Neither does like the high def NES. But,
yeah.
You know the NES Mini didn't, but they added it into the Super NES Mini.
Oh, that's right. So even Nintendo learned. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's. I mean, we can get into the tech crap all day, but it's like that's basically like you know an actual NES signal is just this tiny image. It's only 240 pixels tall or ish. And when you stretch those out to fit in 1080p, it's not a clean multiplication. You know, like you have to actually squash it back down. And essentially, you know, some of the pixels, if you're blowing it up four times, are going to be, you know, 4x4, but some are going to be like 3x4 because the math doesn't work. And interpolation is a way of like softening it on one axis so that it, you know, so everything looks at the expense of a little bit of crispness that I swear to God you cannot see. Yeah. If you're a human being, you lose some sharpness, but you're not jittering anymore and everything.
And you can do like perfect scales within the 1080p screen, but you'll have black around it. There's a lot of people out there be like, I don't want any blank space on my screen.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of old games were designed, you know, at smaller than the full resolution.
But you never see it because of the overscan.
Well, no, not necessarily.
Except for like Final Fantasy III, you'd see it on the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, there are some games, like when you play them, they're kind of, you know, even on a CRT, they're in sort of a box because they were doing so much within that space that they, you know, they had to like cut off the top and bottom star boxes that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can speak to that from Digital Eclipse where like we basically crop in on the games individually based on like where the actual data that you're supposed to see is. So like on SNK40's anniversary, Crystalis, like I cut off like 8 pixels on the left because it's just always black. Mm. And if you just present the game as it is and you put the border on, I learned this from Mega Man Legacy Collection. People are like, why is there this black border? You guys are lazy developers. It's like, no, that was actually there. It's in the Nintendo game. So we started cropping in on them. But even that's just like, well, if you crop in on that Mega Man game, then you're going to miss some of the like level select screen.
Yeah, because different screens are different.
But then when you go into the level, then that part's black. But yeah, like we ended up starting to crop individual games, which we hadn't done before, and that applies to any system. Because to your point, it's like to Star Fox is a really great example. It's like they have black around the screen because I mean they're doing 3D math on a Super Nintendo. They have to like shave off as much as they can to like get that game running at full speed.
Or what passes for full speed?
Sure,
12 frames a second, yeah.
Yeah, it would like 10 frames a second in that game or something.
So you've mentioned, I think we've mentioned upscalers, and you actually called out the Frame Meister, and that's probably worth explaining, because if you do want to use original hardware and play it on an HD TV, like you've got a nice, you know, 60-inch TV, you're going to have some big, chunky pixels, but if you want to play that with minimal lag, there are a few options out there. And basically, upscalers will take the video signal, the 240p video signal, or 480i or 480p, depending on the system you're using, and scale it up to the 1080p resolution of your TV or 4K or whatever you're using. I think right now they top out at 1080p.
Yeah.
But you know, it'll maximize the image. And it'll do it with much less lag than you get through the built-in upscaler on your television. So you don't get that delay where you press a button and it's like half a second later Luigi finally jumps. So that's really important. I think the most popular has been the Frame Meister, the XRGB Mini, but unfortunately that's no longer being produced. They just stopped producing that, so whatever is in stock at Solaris Japan is what exists out there. But there are other solutions available, including the open source scan converter, and that's not quite the same thing. It's a line doubler, but it pretty much does the same thing to the end user. Like it's a different kind of tech, but it's increasing, you know, the number of pixels, and filling out your screen. So, and I think that has even less lag than a Frame Meister, right?
It's zero lag,
yeah. Well, there you go.
I mean, it's such a small number that you might as well just say zero.
I would also, for casual play, like if you want to play on a regular old system on your modern HDTV, and the cheap ones on Amazon, they're okay. Like, have you guys tested these?
Like the SCART to
or even the composite to HDMI like scalers. They're okay.
A lot of the problem is a lot of those scalers will interpret the 240p signal as 480i.
Right, like if so you get the right one. Like some of them don't. And to doubling 240p to 480p, like that's like 80% of like getting old games to look correct on a kind of modern.
It's taking a 240, like a progressive signal, interlacing it, and then making it progressive again.
Okay.
For, you know, for 720.
Do none of them double 240p correctly? The cheap ones?
I mean, there might have been some, but they're even within the same device, like different versions of it.
Yay.
So it's like there's no really.
I just want there to be a $40 thing people can buy, and it's composite, and it works.
But I mean, you look at, like, the open source scan converter is probably the best option, I feel like.
But it doesn't do composite. Like it's like, well, right. Now you got to be one of these RGB weirdos.
But the RetroTINK will do.
Yeah, the RetroTINK does composite, but it doesn't have a comb filter.
But I mean, it will you know, take the 240p and it will double it to 480p.
Right.
And
but
know,
no comb filter, so it looks really bad.
also do S video. Like, yeah, I mean, I think
the S video looks great. Yeah.
Great.
And most systems, not all, will do S video, like old classic systems. So
yeah,
that's a really good compromise. In fact,
oh, it's great. Yeah,
the biggest, awesome. That's like the biggest jump, I feel like, yeah, going from composite to S video.
Yeah, I remember back in the 90s when I finally made the jump from composite to S video, and I was like, wow, I didn't know my games looked like this. I was on PlayStation, and all of a sudden, you know, instead of seeing like transparent stuff, I was seeing meshes and textures and things. I was like, oh, wow, I can actually see how they designed the game. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And RGB is a step above that, but not as big a step. In fact, I'm actually willing to compromise and use S-Video for capture when it's absolutely necessary. This is one of the things I've kind of had to come to terms with this summer, is that I wanted to add Game Boy Advance and Game Boy Color to my capture ability, but there's no official, you know, Nintendo product that will let you capture those in good quality in HD, you know, from real hardware. The Super Game Boy only supports original Game Boy. And you can use the Game Boy Player on GameCube, but the default software is terrible. And there is a way to, like, hack it, but it's very complicated. I've had no luck getting it work, and every time you boot it up, you have to kind of go through a process. Mm-hmm. And I like plug-and-play simplicity because I'm a writer and an illustrator and a video creator. I am not a technical person. I am a creative person, and that means that I look at, you know, schematics and stuff and processes and just kind of say, oh, I can't do this. So I, you know, I started looking around to see what would be a good solution. And to capture these systems, there are dev tools that Nintendo released. There's the WideBoy 64 that plugs into an Nintendo 64 and lets you play Game Boy Color games. And it looks great. And there are video capture devices that they sold to the press back for the GBA days. And the Game Boy Advance dev kit or the capture kit only outputs to S-Video, but I did a capture run with it, and it looks phenomenal. And so I spent a whole lot of money this summer, and please don't tell my wife about this. she's going to be like, why would you do that? But now I have the ability to capture those things, and the quality on it is really great. And, you know, like, I don't feel bad that I'm compromising and, you know, using S-Video for GBA, because it still looks phenomenal.
But you do have the option with the GBA consoleizer.
Yes, and that came along just a little too late for me, having already made this commitment. But yeah, that does look excellent, although it doesn't do analog video out.
Right.
I had to get a PAL GameCube from the UK to spit out RGB, because that's the only GameCube that spits out RGB, and then I used the unofficial Game Boy Player launcher, which is amazing.
Yeah, well, the Game Boy interface by Extremes is incredible. If you have access to, you know, a Game Boy Player on a GameCube, and you have to have the action replay thing that goes in the memory card slot, but it's well worth it, especially if you have component cables. Yeah.
It's great. Something I want to talk about is that, like, we're all in pursuit of this perfect image, and I don't think most games were intended by their artists to look this way. I think that if you're playing an NES game like Mega Man or whatever, like, I think the actual artists drawing those pixels were just using RF on a crappy composite. On a crappy CRT TV.
Yeah.
And, they might have had dev tools where they were, like, you know, painting the pixels, and they could see the perfectly sharp pixels, but then they were looking at the game, you know, on a Famicom over RF into a CRT, and, like, that's what they intended. And I think that there's a really compelling argument that maybe the more accurate way to play something like Mega Man is with some kind of, like, composite interpolator or something on top of it. And, you know, we, like, in our compilation, we did a very fakey, like, composite simulation filter you could turn off and on. And it's, like, when you're on, like, the level select for, I think, like, 2 or whatever, and, like, you turn the composite on, it's, like, suddenly the robots have, like, flesh tones. You know, they like, you can kind of see, like jawbone shadowing and stuff. And it's, like, I think a lot of times this art is meant by the artist to be seen this way.
Yeah.
That was their canvas, and if we're going RGB, we're seeing something that they didn't necessarily intend for us to see. We're looking at these things in a fidelity that they never meant, and it reminds me a lot of, I don't know if anyone reads, like, digital comic books, but when they release a digital comic for, like, an older comic, they interpret the actual colors from the printing plate as being what you're supposed to see, which is really bright and garish, because these colorists knew that they were painting for their medium. They knew it would be on crappy paper, and like they'd get the they'd get a different effect when it went to print. And I think that by trying to get the perfect image off of these older games, that I think were actually, like, in a way, rewriting history.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on, it changes from probably developer to developer.
I think so, too.
Platform to platform. Because, I mean, you have, like, the Master System and Genesis that are capable of outputting mm-hmm. RGB.
Yep.
I'm sure that a lot of developers on those systems use those signals. But then, you know, even Sega themselves, everyone will argue about the dithering in mm-hmm. Sonic and yeah. Waterfall. Like, oh, it's meant to be looked at in composite because, you know, it makes the waterfalls look transparent. You get that rainbowing that makes it look like something the system couldn't normally do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why when I was talking about the word authentic earlier, I kind of used air quotes yeah. on it. Because, you know, it ultimately boils down to what you, the person playing, want. Yeah. I, you know, if you want, like, super crisp, that's great. If you want fuzzy, that's great. Like, you know, pursue what you want. Have the experience that you want. I think that's really the most important thing. Is like it's video games. It's not.
Yep.
It's not the end of the world. Okay. It's supposed to be enjoyable. So whatever it takes for you to enjoy it. For me, you know, it was kind of making that jump from HD back into CRTs, and that was kind of the trigger for me that made me say, oh, yeah, okay, I still do love these games. But you know, everyone's going to have sort of a different like moment, I think.
Yeah, and even for me, like as I'm saying that, it's like, well, I play NES in RGB or like digitally. And it's like I have a weird personal line where it's like NES should be RGB. Anything before that should be composite. So you know, it's at some point it just becomes a personal preference thing. But I think it's worth at least realizing about yourself that part. But also that like we might be interpreting these games in ways that artists never intended us to do, and might not have wanted the games to look.
And I will say, as kind of, you know, we need to wrap soon, but as I coded to this, official emulation is getting better and better. I mean, mm-hmm. aside from the work that Frank is doing at Digital Eclipse, you also have, you know...
Anything M2, that says M2
yeah,
on
anything
it.
Anything with yeah. M2. That's, you know, the Konami collections and the Genesis Mini. Even Nintendo's Mini systems, they're not great, but they're also not bad.
Yeah.
Like, you can plug those in and you can play Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. Well, no, you can't. You can play Punch-Out. And still, you know, fight Mr. Dream without any lag, and that's kind of the important thing I think with that game.
Yeah.
So you know, you don't have to be, you don't have to like give your life over to this the pursuit of purity or anything like that. There are more and more ways to play classic games, and I think as this becomes a growing market, and more, you know, there's more and more feedback, and people see what sells and what doesn't. The threshold of quality increases because people are less willing to settle for, yeah. you know, at games Genesis Mini systems. They want M2 Genesis Mini systems, and that's great. So, you know, maybe the best thing to do for a lot of people is just to kind of sit back and
yeah.
wait for emulation and, you know, official solutions to get better and better, and finally, you know, to hit that point where you're like, this is just how I remember it, or better than I remember it.
And in the meantime, like, something I say, even as someone in this commercial space that, like, sometimes makes a living off of commercial emulation. I think for the most part, the combined knowledge of the quote-unquote amateur emulation scene, the decades of shared knowledge that's gone into making amateur emulators, like, I would trust most of those more than I would trust mm-hmm. most commercial solutions, because it's like people who are really obsessive fans about this stuff who are like,
things.
You know, like tinkering and making things perfect versus like, you know, like a studio that was hired to like crap something out in a month, you know, is not going to have that time to actually put. And even us, sometimes it's like our NES tech, it's okay. Like we got the individual games working, but like we don't have this perfect NES emulator in house because we don't have decades of combined knowledge and time, and it's not a hobby for us, you know? So, point being again, like just go download some emulators and it's fine. It's the real games almost every time.
All right. I think we have a few minutes left. If anyone has any questions or wants to shout something at us, this would be the time for it. Yeah, go ahead. Right there in the blue shirt.
Like, okay, so the question was, at Digital Eclipse, what were some of the challenges trying to emulate these games or make them presentable, et cetera, et cetera? The two big challenges, one is that Nintendo's lawyers have this stance that emulation is illegal, which is complete crap, but... it's something that all of their publishing partners, especially in Japan, like try to respect. So we had to sort of work around that and make a, have a way of emulating NES games that's not actually an emulator. If anyone in this room is an engineer, we just kind of statically recompiled our emulation into C. So there's no emulator on there, but it's the same thing. The other challenge I would say is kind of what I was talking about earlier, which is interpreting the controls for a modern controller for games like Ikari Warriors, etc., where if you were to just map them like binary, like one's rotate clockwise, one's rotate counterclockwise, like that would be the accurate way of doing it, but it that's not the way the artist intended. So that's sort of the other bigger challenge. And like I said earlier, I gave actually 2 GDC talks about this. So there's 2 hours of me talking about this crap if you want to go online. So let me repeat the question in a succinct way. The question is basically, there's different hardware revisions that the same software runs on, and what's the accurate one? What's the goal, right, that we're going for? I mean, I can answer this from the digital close perspective, but do you guys have other takes?
I mean, that's what I was talking about when I said "quote unquote" authentic, because you know it is personal. So I think kind of it's you know a good opportunity for everyone to sort of say like, here's different ways to do this. What works best for me? And you know the game pavilion here, the concourse upstairs, is a great way to experience that right here at Long Island, because you can go out and play a bunch of different systems in a bunch of different formats and technologies, and say like, oh, okay, I like this, or no, this doesn't seem right, and then kind of work backward from there and say, what's good for me?
So for me, I think it's, I always go back to artistic intent, what were the creators intending, and in a lot of cases, it's just, for us, a best guess on which system they were using. I don't think we've necessarily had to do that for any of our compilations, but I think about things like the Famicom disk system. Like different Famicoms have different volume levels for the FDS expansion audio, which probably drives you crazy.
I use the NT Mini, so I can adjust.
Sure, but like adjust to what? Like when? Right. When was this game
what sounds
made?
Good?
And which revision of the Famicom were they using when they
right.
made this game?
Well, and even the software itself. You know, those. If you look at NES packaging, you have like Rev 1, Rev A, whatever.
Yeah.
So the you know, I think there's a Pilot Wings.
Thing
that just
bug.
Came to light
yeah.
where. They changed like the DSP chips, so the demo in the later revisions, the plane always crashes instead of landing safely because the math is different.
Yeah. So, like, I would love to see a future where it's like you switch between them or something, because it's like in a commercial product, for example, it's like we either make the call and say this is the best we can do, this is the best one, or we like have to give you options to switch between things, which is why we do like the composite.
I mean, it's especially apparent with you know, the Sega Genesis,
yeah.
as the you know the audio hardware, and even the same audio chips in the same version of the system changed over time. You know, that's why there's so many revisions of the Genesis, even just like of the Model 1 or of the Model 2. And I mean, you look at something like the Mega SG that it's able to recreate the audio as best as it can. But now, I mean, recently there's a project going on that is called MD Fourier that is analyzing the audio from different versions of the Genesis, and they are trying to finally able to kind of do their best to match it to each individual revision of the Genesis, and hopefully you know maybe there will be an option in later Mega SG firmwares where you can choose from each like every version of the Genesis.
And just on the note of accuracy and audio, like I think that again, like I think in our pursuit of perfection, we're hearing the audio signals in a purely digital way, which is not how they were intended. And I think that the future of that, there needs to be some level of audio filter interpolation.
Audio is probably the toughest thing in
yeah.
games right now, because it's very difficult for people to see they can't see the difference. You know, you're dealing with like YouTube compression or anything, and some people, like as you get older, you can't hear certain frequencies and things that sound different. You know, it's very, very difficult to lock down that kind of thing right now.
All right. Well, I think that is it for our time, but thanks everyone for attending.
Thanks.
And if you have any more questions, if you want to just chat with us afterwards, please feel free. We're going to be around maybe for a little while longer. I don't
yeah.
know. I don't want to speak to these guys,
plane, but
yeah. I need to take off pretty soon too, but catch us before we go, and otherwise just go out and play some old games and say, like, what do I like here? It's a good experience.